Thanks, Rhonda, and welcome to the final closing plenary. As most of you will appreciate, it's an old trick of conference organisers to keep the biggest draw to the last final plenary session, try and keep as many of the delegates present as possible. It seems to have worked pretty well, and that's no surprise because Stephen Heppel is one of the few people in our field who, one of the handful probably, who really does need no introduction from me, but I will give one anyway. I became aware of how good Stephen Heppel was as a speaker when I gave a paper at a conference he was a keynote at. I think it was the Scottish Council for Educational Technology. I think it was in the Glasgow Concert Hall, and and Skep sent us the feedback forms afterwards, and I got 48 and Stephen got 100. So I've set him up now. But seriously, Stephen Heppel has established an exceptional and probably unique place in our field over the last 20 years. There really isn't anyone quite comparable. And the way that Stephen created and led and sustained the Ultra Lab, which itself was a very unusual, very innovative laboratory, a centre of excellence in every sense. Stephen, though, has managed to work in all the sectors that learning technology affects, and he's done so in a way that has always been in the front line of innovation and also close to policy, because one of Stephen's great qualities is his ability to talk, to be unfazed by people in power and to influence them. So I think we're very lucky to have Stephen Heppel to close ALT 2006. Stephen.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be introduced as an enormous draws, you know. Just say fat mostly. I wish I'd been here for the whole time. Here, I would have dearly liked to have heard Tim's talk. You know, content is king. Bit of nostalgia. You know. And I've enjoyed the exhibition. I love the JISC plagiarism advice service stand, which I'm sure I've seen before somewhere. You know. But we haven't got very long, so I thought I'd better focus a bit. And the next generation is just such a good theme. I put it into Google Images, of course, you know, a bunch of dodgy trekkies, you know. But in truth, we're in a very, very different century to the one we started in. And my daughter, personal stuff here, my daughter, there she is, just started, she's a little older now, you know. You know how it is with dads, you know. Just started as a teacher. The 21st century, this would be a teacher, wouldn't it? And I did a little sum for her, totted up the total processing power of her primary school the year she left it at 11. And interestingly enough, the telephone she carries exceeds the processing power of her primary school all those years ago. So, and I guess the same thing's going to happen again. You know, if you've got 11-year-olds, the processing power of their primary schools will be in their pockets as they start teaching. And that's, and the nice thing about, and the phones are, you know, that you can, they're nice, nice, I wouldn't throw the laptop, you know. that's right, it's backed up, you know. Well, I can throw it to somebody else. You know. That pace of change is pretty remarkable. And it's put us in a very different place. But I was coming here, I was trying to think about some of the old stuff, because ALT's been around a mercifully long time. And the earliest I could find of stuff I'd been doing was this old hack together of Prestel and Telecom Gold, which was a extraordinary online learning course, really, for Essex teachers. The amusing thing here was that if you turned up as a teacher, you were directed to the page with the staff room on it. And, of course, all the kids also wanted to try and sneak in there. So after some angst, we thought we'd change the name of the door, and we put over the door, we called it, instead of the staff, we called it Curriculum Matters. And the kids all stopped going, of course, you know. But rather tragically, so did the staff, you know. So you've got to somehow, you've got to get this right socially, I think, above all else. And then some years later, we were playing around with the prototype for the University for Industry. And we were desperate to find ways of getting people to talk online, having been directed into a particular place to get the course kicking off. And we found, we tried all sorts of metaphors, really, which the most successful was the broken train. Now, those of you who are from the United Kingdom will know that nobody ever speaks to anybody here at all. And if a train breaks down, after about an hour and a half, people start to talk. And we built this metaphor of an online broken train. And curiously, when the course finished and people had, had graduated, you know, they were still talking in the carriage, you know, in an extraordinary way. We also built an online beach barbecue, and nobody went at all. It was very other places that would have been more effective. And indeed, when we built schools online all those years ago, you know, of all the things that were attractive to students, the thing that packed them in more than anything else was who's online. And the passports of who are the people that are out here. I think, you know, the reality of 21st century online learning has been staring us in the face for an awful long time. But I think we didn't understand it quite as profoundly as this. So let me put it to you in simple terms, really, that are gonna, you'll retain on the train journey home. It's a new millennium. And in that old millennium, 10 years ago. God, 10 years ago. Tony Blair was still a glimmer in the electorate's eye rather than a tear. We built big things that did things for people. We built rail services. We built a national curriculum in this country, many others. We built Well, the Prime Minister himself came in promising to be a big thing that would do things to people. I don't think he came in promising to be collegiate or to listen. And yet that all seemed to work pretty well in that century. But, of course, in this century, all the success stories are about helping people to help each other. And I think if you go away from here with only one thing firmly lodged in your mind, it's that. And the impact that that has on learning that you really need to hang on to. We're in a century, we're in a millennium of helping people to help each other. Google doesn't have stuff. If I've got things, Seb's got stuff that I'm looking for, he's got stuff that I'm looking for, Google helps us find it. Doesn't do it very, very well because the internet was built a bit wrong, wasn't it? It's built around the idea that you wanted to find stuff rather than people. I've got a universal resource locator, I haven't got a universal person locator, so I can never find anybody, but it'll do. eBay, you know, a couple of months back, I was emptying the house into a skip, as you do, as I do. Kids down the road were emptying the skip and flogging it all on eBay, you know, which was, you've got great stuff, mate, it's brilliant, you know. So they're all broken, you know, just look like laptops. You know. Nobody will know. The impact of that helping people to help each other is hugely profound. Universities were big things that we built to do things for people. And they're not going to survive in that form. Haven't got a hope. I mean, a sector, to be honest, that only celebrates when its clients leave anyway. Has maybe missed something. It's curious, actually, that I do a lot of work in industry and cinema, having the time of my life at the moment, really, and building museums, all sorts of things. The whole of global industry is reinventing itself as collegiate, flat hierarchies, small, agile teams. People raise up to be project managers and then go back down again to be part of the team. And it's extraordinarily viral peer-to-peer sort of management model that the companies are inventing just at the time when our universities seem to be trying to reinvent themselves as 1970s British companies with massive hierarchies and pro-vice-chancellor on pro-vice-chancellor. And you can see it ain't going to happen. But what happens instead, I think, is really, really interesting. What does higher education look like? What does reflection and scholarship and collegiality and delight look like beyond the 19th century university? Well, it's a really interesting place to explore, and we'll certainly talk about it on the way. I mean, you know that some of the traditional things don't work very well. Let's go to Google. Let me make that a bit bigger for you. Let's go off and do stuff like, let me go and buy an essay online. 33 million hits, not bad. And they're all good, you know. Certainly in your professional lives, I hope you're not wasting time writing model answers anymore, you know. What would an appropriate task be for a student in the 21st century? Go and find five essays and pick one and critique the four you chose not to go with. Might be very appropriate. And by the way, rather comfortingly for old 60s chaps like me, if you go and type free essays online, you get 60 million too. So this isn't all about money, is it? Well, universities are struggling with the currency. We thought we knew what learning was. It was read, learn, and inwardly digest. And boy, do we struggle. What we're seeing at the moment is a generation of the most extraordinary children pouring through schools with some exceptional young teachers doing some very cool stuff. They're arriving at university and being told to write it all up in 1,500 words on their own with no conferring. And you know that it struggles. But this is an interesting little slide I did for a really good online GIST conference a little while back, trying to think about what the equivalent was of a 1,500-word assignment. You know, what is the equivalent? You know, in your module reference sheets or in your course descriptions, you know, what else, what would take you as long? How long does it take you to write 1,500 words? Be honest, you know, not an evening. Half an evening if the telly's off. You know. A quarter of an evening if the internet's on. Managing an online discussion for how long? You know, a week would be a big commitment relative to writing 1,500 words. 10-second video, 3-minute podcast. But you can see them yourself. And I think we're in a real mess in the universities at the moment because we really haven't begun to understand what the real equivalences are. And because of that, the penalty for doing something other than traditional forms of learning and assessment are so great that we're forcing children down as students. We're forcing them down extraordinarily narrow corridors. And you know it won't work because everywhere else in their learning lives, the boxes are all getting softer, as you'll see a little later on. So there's some huge challenges ahead of us. And you can see for sure your students will be standing up in court with you in 2 or 3 years' time talking about the inadequacy of your courses because the portfolio of possibilities of assessment didn't begin to be delivered on the course. We only had essays for 3 years. That's about 10% of the course. I'd like my 30 grand back, please. It would be not an unreasonable position. So it is a very challenging time, and it's a time, don't sit back and rely on policy, for goodness sake. Here's, I love this. This is the English and Welsh governments, higher standards, better schools for all document. The white paper that currently guides our schools, and I could show you many like it from around the world, and if I go in there and look for the things that you would regard as comforting, let's go and look for standards, look at 135 references, to sound, thank goodness. You know. Let's just check that failure's still there. Phew. 53 to fail. See how prescient policymakers are with this stuff. Let's go and look for creativity. create anything. Just about the creation of a system. Nodding off already. Let's go and have a look for global. Only two references, and if I look on the page here, what's this one? It's a reference to standards must be global. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. So you're not going to be told what to do by wise policymakers. You're indeed going to be asked what you should be doing by ingenious students. This is a peer-to-peer, viral, bottom-up, person-takes-all world, and it's enormously exciting. And I can't imagine anything more challenging for the way we've organised education than that. Let's look at what some kids are doing of different ages. Here's... Oh, this is a nice one. Let's look at this. Yeah, I think this deserves to be bigger. I'll talk over this, so I'll just turn the sound down for a moment. This is... I have an event, if those of you around London in October will happily come along to this. It's an event in London called Be Very Afraid. We bring in children, undergraduates, and they show off the stuff they're doing with new technology. This girl has built a kinetic sculpture. The kinetic sculpture represents her communication life. Each of these fibre optic rods behind her represents one person in her life. She's collected and put into the database all the text messages, phone calls, written mails, conversations that she's had with all her friends and family. And she now sits down and she's replaying that quarter of a year here in a day as those rods twitch. There's Auntie Maud getting her message. Look, having a bit of a twitch. And she's describing here how the light in each rod represents the volume of communication she's had with. And she's describing this as a garden of communication that she's tending, and she's reflecting on how some parts of her friends and family are grievously neglected, where others are glowing with the warmth of her regular missives. That's an extraordinary way to see the world. It's what our young learners are doing. She's an undergraduate, this girl. Let's have a look at the younger ones, though, because you'll think that doesn't happen until they get to college. Let's have a look at... this one's rather good, and I think they deserve, you can hear from them yourselves. We've been doing a noun rap, in case that just slipped you by there. You know. Help people to help each other, just remember that as you listen to how they're sorting out the boys. Leave that there for you. Give me a pronoun. Who, me? Well done. Now, what is that? Is that English? Is that communication? Is that music? Is that ICT? Is cool? You can see that discipline box that we used to put learning into, the edges have blurred, collapsed, really. Project-based learning around the world, storming ahead. Quality of children's learning, spectacular, stellar, when the conditions are right. I'm doing a lot of policy work in the Caribbean at the moment. The promise I have to the electorate there is that we're going to double children's performance in 4 years. It's an easy promise to make. We'll way exceed that. So, one of the big issues here is I don't know how good learners can be. But I'm absolutely confident they can be way better than they are at the moment. And that's a huge challenge for us. How do we respond to that? How do we do it? What happens if they go off and do their learning somewhere else? They will go off and do their learning somewhere else. China will be a net importer of undergraduates within, well, used to be 5 years, within 4 years now. You're a youngster, you think, where shall I go to do my university degree? Shall I go to Beijing? Meet some people who are going to be jolly useful to me in my future life. Learn Mandarin. pay minimal bills, live cheap as chips. If I'm good, they'll employ me for a couple of years afterwards. Or shall I go to Hull or Bangor? You know, it's a tough call. Both lovely places, by the way. Well, they're by the sea, so I'm going to like them. You know. It's a global learning world that we're in. You look down at your shoes, they were probably made in, which I don't know, God knows where Sebs were made, but they were probably made in Italy, or your computer was made, assembled in Cork, maybe, with a screen made in Korea, components designed perhaps in Cambridge, and a circuit board put together in California. And you think we're in a world of national curriculum and national universities? Of course we're not. Of course we're not, any more than the British motorcycle industry was a British motorcycle industry once. By the time they'd noticed it was a global motorcycle industry, they'd gone. And that's the same challenge we're seeing right now in higher education. So exciting times, really, and perhaps all the more exciting because of the quality of what's happening elsewhere. People are responding to this. They're not just saying crumbs. Learning's changing, let's sit back and see where it goes. They're doing extraordinary things. I'm just going to show you a few little examples of those here. This is Rees High School in Tasmania, a school that was so bad the children burnt it down. It's a nice evaluation model now. Next time you're on a course committee, you know, how bad was the course? Well, it's still standing, you know. We lost Bill, of course, in proof, you know. I warned him, Tweed, you know, it's going to go. And what they built instead is fabulous. The community, the children, the teachers, all stood around and said, dear God, let us not do it again the way it was before. Let's build something that's full of community, that's got small, intimate home bases in it, where we see each other and we meet each other on a daily basis. Let's build something that feels personable. Let's feel something where, look, content is not king. You know, we're in an age of free information. Let's build something where maybe we notice that in the 21st century, content ain't king, but at least community might be sovereign. Let's build a place around community. You can see how some of our mega universities are embracing their content rather than embracing their students. And you know that they'll be gone pretty quickly. Tasmania, they knew that. Because they tried it the wrong way around and the kids didn't come. And now, well, as an interesting measure that Australian schools measure children misbehaviours, and the incidence of children misbehaviour in this school have gone down by better than 80% since they re-engineered it. But you'll notice that intimacy is at the heart of all this. These little tiny learning blocks, these home bases where children spend much of their time, really matter. Here's a school in the Caribbean. It's not very big, but this half, that's the neighbours. and here's the head's office. you're right, it did used to be a potting shed. And here's a school that I'm chair of the Board of Governors. This is in Hindhead in Surrey. This school opened with three children. It's massive expansion since it's four now. 30%, don't knock it. it will never have 10. How can that be viable? How can that possibly work? Well, of course it can, because geographical proximity is no longer a primary driver of economies of scale. Schools can talk together. Universities can talk together. What's the optimum size for a university? 20? 100? Whew, getting a bit big. Certainly not 1,000. Now, that's really interesting, isn't it? What do they talk about? Well, here's just down the road from the school in the Caribbean. This is after Hurricane Ivan swept through, and it was a mess. This one's on Grand Cayman. And the people who owned this house just walked away, left the keys behind, and toddled off. 18 months later, the kids are watching the undergrowth take over the place. And the kids in Hindhead are gripped by this. They've never seen anything grow so fast. Meanwhile, of course, the kids in the Caribbean are gripped by the traffic jams on the A3 outside the school in Hindhead. They've never seen anything go so slow. and they love to look out of the window through the webcam and see the cars not moving. I mean, it's a whole other world for them. Why? He was there yesterday. It's a world of ICT. It's information and communication technology. And that means we don't have to be next door to each other. It means we don't have to be physically located. It means scale really, really doesn't matter anything like as much as it used to. And I've shown many of you this. I apologise for showing you, but it's pretty cool. This is in Thailand. This is the top floor of a shopping mall in Thailand, TK Park in Bangkok. And it's a learning space built for families and communities. They figure they haven't got time to fix education. So they're just going to get learning going as fast as they can in the community, in the family. And it's a fabulous place, a place of branding rather than uniformity. What a bizarre thing it is that we do with learners to try and make them uniform. I mean, you'd be almost unemployable if you were uniform. You want them to be ingenious and gregarious and collaborative and engaged. You remember, some of you in university will remember when to get a first-class degree you had to surprise your lecturers. Now, if you don't surprise them at all, that's the best way to get a first-class degree. Oh, yeah. Saw that on Google just the other day. Here, it's full of surprise. It's full of, look, there's the library. And just to get the books there, you've got to shit up there and get them down. You know, it's lovely stuff. Well, crumbs, look. There are some huge issues that are facing us, some big issues. And I thought we'd just explore a few of those in the little bit of time we've got left, which isn't vast. And these are the things that are really going to determine whether universities make it or whether universities end up being railway stations. You know, railway stations were once things we were proud of nationally. They're not anymore. They're places you go to when you're desperate, and mostly you regret it, and they're abnormally expensive. Sound familiar? Let's think of some of the issues. Firstly, there's a whole mass of social issues. If we build a world of product-based learning, we know what's going to happen. What's going to happen is kids will find a way around it. Here's a couple of reports from Scottish newspapers. What's happening, of course, all around the world? We've got kids who've got ADHD. They can't concentrate to save their lives. We give them Ritalin. And what do? They flog it to the kids who are trying to pass the exams, as you'd expect, really. Straight to eBay, you know. And just try typing Ritalin into eBay just before the exam season. Oh, of course, it works. It helps them to concentrate. Of course, it's safe for children because we're giving it to children. So, you know, if we build a world where the only performance is how high, people are going to find chemical ways to jump higher. And that doesn't sound to me the sort of social, collegiate, gregarious, exciting learning that we're all about. I'm engaged in a project for the World Bank, for UNESCO, there's a Microsoft funding behind it called Learnometer. And the Learnometer project is really, really interesting. The challenge is, if we spend money on learning for our new generation of learners, what gets better? How do we know that the money was worth spending? In England, the government's spending £60 billion on new schools. By 2011, every single child will have an annual £1,000 a year spent on capital alone. These are massive projects by any scale, probably even more expensive than the war. How do we know it's worth it? What gets better? Well, interestingly enough, one of the things I've done as part of this project is to go out and ask ministers all around the world. They've said, OK, chaps, you're spending a lot of money. What do you think is going to get better? And it's a really encouraging list of stuff. Look, here are the outputs that they're embracing, that they're expecting to see as a result of their investment in learners. That's a pretty encouraging list, isn't it? Peace. I'm up for that. Ingenuity. Kids who can critique better. Now, the tough thing is, how are we going to measure this? Well, it's not impossible. Indeed, it's, these days it's easy peasy. You think about cinema, you know, Pride and Prejudice, when it was refilmed, Keira Knightley, the Joe Knight version, which is compelling if you haven't seen it in the cinema, has a different ending in America to here. Here, you know, there's a smouldering staring into the eyes. It's rather nice, really, like the book. You know. In America, there's a full-on snog. And doubtless they tested out a bit of, you know, under the juvie action as well, which presumably they rejected. And you don't go out and spend several million on refilming the end of a movie unless you're absolutely certain that people have enjoyed that particular version. And we should be doing the same with learning. We should be looking at how we measure these very things. Well, that's what the Learnometer project is all about. It's building a dashboard of indicators that help people to see, to select and choose their own metrics and then be held accountable to them. And I'll tell you what, I bet I could even measure smiles. Simple face recognition. What would you measure? Whether people were smiling when they came on campus or when they left Terry? What would you? They'd both be interesting indicators, wouldn't they? What's happening around the world in learning is also part of this project's task to collect. And here's pretty much that indicator board. This is what's happening. Here it is. That's pretty stark. I'm sure it's what you've been talking about most of the last 3 days. We're moving from stable to agile. We're moving from one size fits all to personalised. And personalised doesn't mean individualised learning. It's amused to hear that Tim was making reference to learning in the army yesterday. It's very much individualised learning. You really want to know who can shoot who and how well, don't you, presumably? Personalised learning is about learning styles, about your culture and your context and what fits you better. We're moving from interactive to participative. Interactive learning, click and watch, gee. We want people to make and show and create. When I say make and show and create, I mean the world is awash with this stuff. If I just wander on to, let's have a little wander over to perhaps YouTube. You know, so here we are on YouTube. How many people are watching YouTube every day? How many people are watching YouTube every day? 15 million people. The last time the BBC got numbers like that was the Morecambe and Wise Christmas show or whatever. So here's this extraordinary video, by the way, of sixth formers who've posted it on helping other sixth formers to learn. This is helping people to help each other. I see, just curiously, there down at the bottom, I don't know if you just see it, do-it-yourself masturbation, you know? Leaving aside, I see it's spelt wrong as well. The old eyesight going. You know. Helping people to help themselves as well, then, presumably. But here's Teachers TV. I'm on the board of Teachers TV. And Teachers TV, television about how to teach. By teachers for teachers. Vast government investment. It's very cool if you're not watching it on Sky or Sky Plus. It's on the internet. Over 1,500. Well, let's have a look. 1,500 programs on the internet. Let's go to the video library. Come on, make that a bit bigger so you can vaguely see it. You're just going to be general, aren't you? Yeah, why not? And what are you going to care about? Well, Parents Guide. We'll just add the holidays, you know. what's on there? And look, program after program after program. For parents about teaching. Children are watching this in large numbers. Children are watching how to teach maths before they go to their maths lessons. Have you seen this stuff, sir? Look. You know, no criticism, but it's worth a look, you know. Those children are coming to you. Teachers TV was set up to make the programmes that we're now awash with offers from schools saying, we're doing some really cool stuff, we've got video, we just want to make the programme and send it, are you interested? Helping people to help each other. So in a school in Haverhill this week, they've abandoned their assemblies, The children's media team now do the assembly. They put all the stuff together. The head teacher wants to talk to the school. She makes an appointment with the kids. The kids video it in between stuff about the netball victory and the next great band. And it goes out in its podcast. And parents are all watching this stuff in a podcast sort of way, helping people to help each other. So we're in a very interesting world. We're in a world where the big issues also include workplace learning. It's bizarre, isn't it, that we should ask people to stop work, to come to university to learn, and then charge them so much that while they're learning, they have to start work. Take them out of the good job they were doing in the art gallery and give them a degree in art history, and for 3 years they fill shelves in Tesco's. Can't imagine anything more stupid. Well, we know that the alternative works really, really, really well. Here's what happened when we put workplace learning undergraduate degrees together. This is controversial stuff because this is Ultraversity degree, which you may know about, been running out of Ultralab for some years. The graduates just literally, first cohort of graduates just went through this summer. 45% of them got firsts. Staggering. The problem for the whole course was getting people to write down to a level. They just kept wanting to write stuff at master's levels. And you can see this sort of comment from somebody early on the project. You know, they wanted their learning to be validated when they started at a very classical model, traditional model of learning. But very quickly they realised that it was the community of people that was the value of the course. It's a people thing, by people, for people, through communities. What happens in schools when we gave that degree to the many non-graduates? Here's a head teacher talking about the experience in his school. I'm sorry this is a tiny bit of video, but shot with a phone, of course. But it's worth just listening to him anyway.
I think that coming to the background of education so much, I see it in this school here, amongst the students, is raising self-esteem. And belief, self-belief, in actual fact, a lot of people misperceive their own abilities. An enormous number of people underestimate themselves. Now, what schools should do is actually bring reality home to people. And I think when I'm online degree like this, certainly what I've seen around here, certainly I've seen it. I've seen people get, or how I almost as my mother used to call it, more prideful. I've seen people get more of a tip about themselves about it, thinking, I'm on my way. I've seen them boast about it. Right? I must be the only school, I'd say, the country where I can say all of my learning assistants are doing degrees. And they support each other, they back each other. So
support each other, and they back each other. And look, this is what I'm doing with the teachers themselves, because it just seems to me that professional teachers sitting reflecting on a daily basis about the quality of learning that they're managing and engendering and inspiring need to be reflecting that as a research-based task. And this is kicking off in 6 countries around the world this year. Whole cohorts, whole staffs of schools. But the hypothesis is shared. The hypothesis is our school could be better. And the scholarship is not going to be going away and reading journal items and chapters and traditional PhDs in the library shelves. The scholarship is looking to what other practitioners are doing. What can we learn from the street schools in Brazil? What can we learn from Tasmania? What can we learn from that? Scholarship is becoming detective work in an exhilarating sort of way. And the action research project is, let's make our school better and the whole cohort graduate with a doctorate when it improves. I promise you, I stand here and promise you, in 10 years' time, teaching will be a fully doctoral profession. Every school will be a centre of research excellence. Now, you map that onto what Tim was saying yesterday about Edinburgh's future, because it has a lot of content, it's got great research and it's big, and you can see why I'm nervous for it. There are other really big issues sitting in front of us as well, and let's just rehearse the last couple of those, and then we're going to go to questions. It's a global thing, as I've said before, but look, isn't this interesting? I'm launching, with others, over the next 18 months, a suite of global examinations. They're free at the point of use. There's no charge to the governments, no charge to anybody, actually. They're just going to give them away. high quality, quality assured, global, multicultural, and free. How can that possibly work? Well, I had a very interesting meeting with the chaps from Skype, you know, the internet phone. And I said to them, what's your business model then, chaps? And they said, we haven't got one. But we do know in 5 years' time, all phone calls will be free. They will be. And we hope about half of them will be ours. At that point, we'll put a business model together. I think that's roughly what's going to happen with exams. So what an interesting time we're in at the moment. Imagine the impact of free global exams for all. Exhilarating. Democratising. Scary. This is one of the models, is the portfolio GCSE, where children will be able to study anything they like as long as they pass it through those four, across those four pillars of being able to create and critique and collaborate and communicate. And if they're a kid throwing the javelin for the Olympics, I'd offer them a treble accreditation for that. There's all the biomechanics of throwing the thing, the aerodynamics, the nutrition and well-being stuff. That's basically how far you throw it as well. And that sounds to me like a pretty good 14 to 16 exam. And we're going to have thousands of children doing thousands of entirely different exams. But the process is common, the product will be unique. So we're in an extraordinary time of variety and variation. And probably the place we should stop and go to questions, Terry, is just here. I'm chair of the governors, as many of you know, of notschool.net. It's a virtual school for children who've been excluded from school. First graduates from that passed through as successful undergraduates this year. What's extraordinary about Not School is that these kids, their performance is up from zero. They passed nothing before. This is a project of the last resort. It costs me no more to educate them than it would cost if they were being educated in a school. It's entirely virtual, entirely sit at home where the computer's been running for, 6 years now? Long time. And it works beautifully. But look at that reflection you get from the children when you ask them about their learning. Well, those are some good figures, by the way, but the bit I wanted to come down to was here. And here's a child, incredibly self-aware of their learning style, reflecting on how well-placed they are to move forward as a lifelong learner in the world of work and parenthood and citizenship that awaits them. These are children who would have had ASBOs slapped on them. And it's really a fascinating point to reflect that nowhere in our education system, almost nowhere, do we teach or encourage our learners to be social or sociable. We've just been through the ritual in the United Kingdom of children opening their envelopes and taking out their exam certificates. There's only one name on the exam certificate. You only see them open them one at a time. If they were trying to do coursework with their parents, then the fundamentalist exam lunatics would be rushing around trying to shred their coursework. We're in a world where they collaborate naturally. And when you build an environment that suits them like that, kids move ahead in a stellar sort of way. Children in Not School, having been excluded from school, are outperforming the children in the schools they've been excluded from in substantial numbers. And I've just posted a letter to Downing Street. Not quite sure he's going to open it now, but just posted a letter saying, look, I can take 50,000 children out of poverty, and break the cycle of deprivation, can do it. We've tested it. It's cost-effective. It works right now. Are you up for it? Do you want to do it? Because if not, we're going to do it somewhere else. It'll be really interesting to see, A, who opens it, and B, what they say about that. And I tell you honestly that in 1997, I stood on a platform with Tony Blair, talked about the ICT policy for an incoming Labour government, which I helped write. And as he stood there, at the end of the session, he said to all the journalists, put your pens down, put your pads down. Sometime down the line, this is going to be tough times for all of us, but I'll tell you what, the bit you'll remember about what I did was I transformed learning and education. So if he opens it, it'll be very interesting to see if that's where his heart still is. You know where my heart is. The question is, where is learning going to live? It's going to be a people thing. It's going to be community-based. It's going to be by and for each of us. What's the role for a traditional institution in that? I don't know. But it's a different role to the one you thought it was, I think. Let's go to questions, Terry.
We do have a roving microphone, Stephen.
Excellent. So the trick here is on questions on the back and get him running. Come on, let's have some.
Could you put your hand up if you have a point or a question? This is the audience participation part of the event. And the microphone will come to you.
Oh, and there are free DVDs for anybody who asks a question, I should have said. Just thought I'd mention it. Somebody will get it to you. It'll get to you, don't worry. Well, I mean, you're right to worry, but I've stopped worrying, because if they don't change, they're gone. And to be honest, you know, as the tow truck starts to take away the vice chancellor's second chauffeured car, you know, it'll dawn on him. It'll dawn on him. Maybe too late, maybe not. But I mean, this will happen somewhere. I mean, I'm doing it, you know, and on a global scale, and people are coming in hundreds of thousands. So it's going to happen. The tough question is whether it's going to happen here. And, I mentioned the railways earlier. You know, if this had been the Association of Railway Engineers in the 1950s, we'd have all been feeling pretty smug. We've got the standards right, the track all joins up, we've got the timetable sorted, we know exactly what we're doing. And over there somewhere, people were buying cars, and we're saying we've anticipated every journey exactly. We know, in fact, even we found people making the wrong journeys. We shut those branch lines, hopeless, you know. And we've told them what journey they should be making. Job done. And over here, the people buying cars are saying, this is pretty cool. But, you know, why would I ever get on a train? Now I've got a car. I mean, that's exactly the situation. You don't have to go to university to graduate or to do research or to be a postgraduate. So, you know, we're competing vigorously with some pretty cool stuff. And you know, wise up or gone is the quick answer. I've really stopped worrying.
There's a question from George.
It'll get there. You'll have to stay focused, or these things are going to kill you.
Thank you. I just did it for the DVD. Just given that, just for example, the science curriculum seems to be constituted in a discussion about national competitiveness and the requirements of British industry to have more and more people with a particular set of skills, which is then tied into a whole, if I can just call it an economic order. I just want to argue against the inevitability of the Vice Chancellor's second car being towed away, because without there being quite some struggle, because there's an awful lot of people interested in doing things the way we are doing it. I don't say that that's a good thing, but I just wondered if you comment on that struggle there.
No, I mean, you're wise to point it out. Over in Ireland at the moment, where you know, some of you know I've been over there quite a lot lately. A big problem is that lack of computer scientists, lack of good engineers. And the national project, which is in some secrecy, so please don't write this down if you're journalists. No, that's a promise, come on. We're going to have a national project where people are asked to control light. And children, community groups are going to do. And they're going to do laser installations on the roofs. They're going to do things a bit like that girl's wonderful kinetic sculpture. They're going to do some extraordinary stuff. It's all being featured on regional and then national television, people voting by text for the best ones. And who's sponsoring that? It's the people who desperately need those computer scientists and those engineers. Of course, it's Google and Intel and Apple and IBM. You know, where's the universities in all that? Straight past them all. So, you know, they either get on board or they're gone. I'm absolutely confident about that. I would say, I really, really hope they get on board. I mean, I can't think of many more communities where it's more pleasant to sit down in a senior common room and have a conversation at a decent, stretching, engaging intellectual level than a university. So I mean, it would be a catastrophe if they went. But they're not going to survive the way they are now. And they're not the collegiate institutions they once were. All degrees are part-time. All students are full-time doing a job and fitting in their study where they were. You know, the intimacy of the tutorial's gone, the intimacy of the seminar's gone. And it's gone because people didn't think different. They just kept saying, productivity, how can we do more, cheaper, faster? They never said, how can we do different? And the minute you say, how can we do different, there's the only hope of survival. Challenging distance. Oh, it's one down there. I might get to him. You know. There he is. Yeah. I'll come to that. Whoever the hand up was behind that I couldn't reach, come and get it afterwards. You know, let's have that question from there. Once.
Thank you. The question is, we've heard a lot of this stuff before in the 60s, and it didn't go anywhere. How do we know it's going to go somewhere this time?
Oh, because we didn't have information communication technology. I mean, you know, Summerhill was a cute idea, but it didn't have direction, didn't have focus, didn't have anywhere joining up with other people in the world. And I'm not talking about that 60s kind of laissez-faire model of, hey, well, let's learn a bit of stuff and that'll do, you know. I'm talking about something that's very, very, very focused, very output-centric. But the outputs are project-based, the focus is collaborative, and the excitement is palpable. And that's the difference, absolutely is the difference.
So it's more than just a technology.
Oh, God, the technology as a... See, some of you are as old as me, and you came into this, wrestling with sort of BBC computers, and the whole battle as we're building those online learning communities in the 70s and 80s, the battle was, can we persuade the technology to do what we want? That's gone. You know, where we are now is, the technology can do anything you want. What would you like to do? And that's not just a bigger challenge, but there's an awful lot of people out there asking the same question. You know, and some of them are the NHS, and some of them are, you know, and they're saying, what I'd like to do is produce scholarly, reflective, collaborative, ingenious, engaging, delighted minds. I want to get on with that. We don't have a monopoly on that in universities, anything like. So we're just in a big club all of a sudden where we weren't before. And I think it's exhilarating. That's good.
Thank you.
Who would like to ask the last question?
One right up there, Terry. It's not fair to be penalised, these chaps, for being so distant. You'll have to come and get it afterwards. It's there.
What seems to be unique in a university, in the university context, is that they issue degrees and certification. In this new social order, how are people going to be able to judge?
That's a very tenuous thread to put you on. Would you want to bet your mortgage on that? I mean, that if a certificate appeared that said, you know, this person is reflecting at what we consider to be a postgraduate level, and the signatures on the thing were the BBC and Oracle and Microsoft and the Science Museum and, you know, 20 or 30 others, it would trump anything, absolutely would trump anything. You know, we only hold on to accreditation because nobody else has thought to take it from us. You know, if all we've got in universities is the ability to generate a certificate, we're gone even quicker than I think. It must be more than that. It must be. I mean, one of the things that's spectacularly important in learning as an undergraduate is the community of people that you join with and the people that you learn with and the people you're going to still be able to exchange ideas and thoughts with in a later life. That didn't matter so much when many of you were young because you were on a sort of career for life model, but the kind of portfolio organic CVs that our students are assembling in the world of work, you know, the thing that holds them all together is the vectors and velocities, if you like, of the community of friends that they've assembled. They've assembled those in universities. The single most valuable thing that universities have got is the ability to generate communities of practice where the practice is learning. And I despair sometimes looking at university architecture to say to myself, is this a building designed to generate collaborative endeavour? Is this about community? Mostly it's about some bloke gave him a lot of money and he wants a big entrance with his name over the door, you know, some distance from the rest, so you can see that he's jolly important. You know. We're not doing well enough, I don't think, at enhancing the things that really matter. And what really matters is not going to be accreditation. You know that.
It says on my running order, 12:45, Terry thanks Stephen.
That's great, thanks.
Hello, everyone. It's my great honour and pleasure to start to finish the conference by thanking everybody who's made such a significant contribution to what I hope you will agree has been another successful ALTSI conference. So first of all, I'd like to start off by thanking our four invited theme speakers. I'm sure you'll agree they've really challenged us and got us talking to one another, thinking, and so on. So I'd like to thank Gilly Salmon, Terry Anderson, Phil Candy, and Chris Yap. We do have some really good bottles of wine for you. Please do come and collect them at the end. Please do join with me in thanking them. Conference wouldn't be a conference without people who contribute to the programme committee and planning and thinking and reviewing and so on. And so I do have to thank our ALTSI 2006 programme committee, the ALT-J referees who refereed the research papers, and others who helped us review all the contributions to the conference. Please do help me in thanking those. I'd like to move on now to thank our co-chairs of the programme committee, Ron Oliver and Terry Mays, who've done a sterling job. Working with them, particularly in producing the proceedings for the conference, have been Denise Whitelock, Steve Wheeler, Stylianos Hatzipanagos, Ian Smith and John Phelps. Oh, and you've all got bottles of wine. Please do come and collect them at the end. So please join me in thanking them. And we've been delighted to come back to Edinburgh. We were last here in 2001 at Edinburgh University, and it's been great to be here at Heriot Watt. And so I'd like to thank the Heriot Watt Conference office staff, in particular Aileen and Muriel. And again, Aileen and Muriel, there are bottles of wine for you too. So please join me in thanking those too. I'd like to thank the catering and accommodation staff and the Heriot Watt technical support team. I'm sure you agree with me, they've been really helpful in dealing with all our queries during the last 3 or 4 days. And also the conference assistants. There are too many to name, but they have been absolutely brilliant, really helpful. So please do thank them. And again, too many to name, but I do want to thank our conference sponsors who have contributed to making ALTSI a successful event. So please do thank our sponsors. And it's not on the list that Rhonda wrote me, so I'm going to ad-lib now. I would like to thank you all, because I think what makes ALTSI a really great conference to come to is the community of people, the community of delegates who are willing to talk, discuss, collaborate, argue, challenge. And it's that, it's you, I think, that really does help to make ALTSI great and brilliant. So thank you all. Edinburgh's been great. I want you to now think about next year. Next year we're in Nottingham, and it's my great pleasure to hand you over to Professor Mike Sharples, who'll be co-chairing our conference next year in Nottingham, who's going to whet your palate for what's going to happen next year.
Thank you. Well, it's going to be a hard act to follow. And I don't just mean Stephen Heppel's talk. Wasn't it great? And some real challenging ideas for us to think about over the next year. Superb talk. And, of course, only Stephen Heppel can rename the internet after himself, HeppelNet. So, onwards. The next conference is going to be in Nottingham, AltC 2007, 4th to 6th of September. So get out your organisers, diaries, paper and pencil, if you've still got them, and put that down. The theme, I think there's just about one thing that was in common between Stephen Heppel's talk and Tim O'Shea's talk, and that is the recognition that learners are increasingly beyond the control of institutions, which is great because that's the theme of the conference next year, learning technology for the social network generation. So here are some of the sub-themes. Learning with blogs, wikis, multiplayer games. It's an emerging theme at this conference. It's clearly going to be an important issue next year. Learning and internationalism. Again, it's been a key theme of Stephen Heppel's talk. We really have to understand now how people learn in a world of global culture, global learning, global institutions. Designing learning spaces. What does it mean to design a learning space ranging from a handheld device to an entire campus or an entire city? How can we design small and large-scale learning spaces? And also large-scale implementation, distance learning, network learning, policy and infrastructure for technology-enhanced learning. I hope within these themes there is going to be enough for you to fit into. The themes aren't meant to be restrictive. It's up to you to interpret those themes in your own ways. I'm one of the co-chairs. The other co-chair is Sharon Waugh from Anglia Ruskin University. And I'm glad to say we've already got some keynote speakers for next year. So we're ahead of the game. Professor Sir Colin Campbell is going to give the welcoming keynote. Michelle Selinger, who is a superb speaker and is coming from a very interesting background, both of academia and also from industry. And Peter Norvig, Director of Research at Google. And I don't know how many talks I've been to that have mentioned the G word. Well, this is the G man. He's the guy who is in charge of research for Google. So I'm sure it's going to be very interesting, the perspective on education from Google and Peter Norvig. So those are the keynote speakers. University of Nottingham. I know that Nottingham has had a bad press over the last year. We did think of holding it in an inner-city housing estate riddled with drug problems. It would be really interesting to try and understand education in that environment. But instead, it's going to be held in the beautiful campus of the University of Nottingham. So that's part of the University of Nottingham campus. That's the East Midlands Conference Centre. Superb facilities, like here, very similar, purpose-built conference centre. That's the reception area. That's the lecture hall. And that's the bar. I really don't know why our marketing office chose this photograph of the bar. A rather sad-looking man standing in the corner looking at a laptop. This is not what the bar is going to look like next year. And the call for papers. I've discovered that large conferences like AltC are rather like a supertanker. It's very difficult to change direction. I've been talking to some of you about the things that you would like to have for next year's conference. I would really like to hear from you about what worked in this conference, and there are many things that work superbly about this conference, superbly well organised, some fascinating talks. I'd also like to hear about what didn't work and what can change. We're not going to be able to bring about all the changes for next year, but we want to move that supertanker of AltC off into some new directions. Particularly, we ought to be putting our technologies into practice. We're talking about interactivity. We're talking about engagement of learners. We need to put that into practice in our conference, and we want to find out some innovative ways to do that. So we've got the fairly traditional lineup here, but I also want to look for new ways of engaging people, perhaps new types of workshop demonstrations. Please come to me with suggestions. So, the key dates. The conference is in September. The closing dates for research papers is 14th of February 2007. Other streams close 28th of February 2007. I hope you will now start thinking and writing in time for those closing dates. So, AltC 2006 is over. Long live AltC 2007. See you there.